Good evening, everyone. I'd like to call the Joint Special Committee on Land Use Fairness to order, and thank you for being here tonight. We have some preliminaries. This is our first meeting to be having for the Joint Special Committee on Land Use Fairness, and so we have some housekeeping we need to take care of. First of all, for those who are here, we welcome that you are here. There are a few rules that we have based on making sure that everyone understands these proceedings are being recorded, audio and video. If you have a cell phone or some type of communication device, they need to be turned off. They cannot just be in the silent mode. The problem is that some technology will interfere with our new and old and, let's say, weak electronic equipment, and it will actually cause interference on that. So if you would be so kind during our meetings to make certain that when you come in that you have turned those off. And there is one, let's see, and also for members, these microphones that we have, those are new. They're so new that they actually have the ability to pick up side conversations. So if you don't want to have your side conversation recorded, you may think about that before you make whatever comments that could be on the air and out to Oregon and everywhere else on the web.
That dancer.
With that said, I think what we're going to do some just very briefly, since we're starting as a new committee, it's a joint committee to do some self-introductions. I am Senator Floyd Przanski. I represent Senate District 4. My district includes parts of Lane and Douglas County and a very small portion of Coos County. Co-chairing on the House side is?
Greg McPherson. I represent House District 38, which is Lake Oswego and part of Southwest Portland. But I feel I have a little broader perspective because I grew up on a Linn County dairy farm. And then why don't we start down at the far end and have self-introductions from each of our House members.
Thank you. I'm Brian Clem, a representative from here in Salem. My district is central Salem and runs to east Salem in an unincorporated chunk inside the urban growth boundary and right up to the urban growth boundary of Cordon Road in between Lancaster and Cordon.
I'm Representative Patty Smith, representing District 52, Hood River County, East Multnomah, and a great portion of Clackamas County, and I believe Hood River County is ground zero for Measure 37.
I am Representative Arne Roblin from District 9. Live in Coos Bay. My district goes up the coast from Coos Bay to Florence, so it includes parts of Coos, Douglas, and Lane County.
I'm Bill Garrard, House District 56, which is Klamath Falls and all of southern Klamath County.
And Kurt?
Kurt Schrader, State Senator, Senate District 20 from the newly subdivided, commercialized, industrialized Clackamas County area.
Roger Baez, State Senator, District 9, which is parts of that area that he just described that I would say is rural, Clackamas County, East Marion County, and East Linn County.
I'm Betsy Johnson, Senate District 16, all of Clatsop, Columbia, and Tillamook County, a nibble of Washington County out by Banks and Sauvie Island that includes Multnomah County. I'm a Central Oregonian by birth. If Mr. McPherson gets to claim his heritage, I come from Central Oregon.
I'm Larry George, represent Senate District 13, which reaches from Hag Lake out past Forest Grove through South Washington County, portions of Clackamas County, Yamhill County, and all the way down to Kaiser.
Thank you, everyone, for being here, and thank you for being willing to serve in this capacity. As you can tell, our meeting is starting at 5 p.m. Our time slot is basically 5 to 7 on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Depending on the needs, we may have to adjust those schedules, so stay tuned and watch the notices as they come up. At this point, we want to adopt the committee rules. We've asked Rona Kennedy from the House, who's one of the is the parliamentarian for the House, who's worked with our parliamentarian as well as I think the leadership offices to give some clarification because some of the members had some issues. And so, at this point, I think Ms. Kennedy, if you could just maybe tell us how these rules were developed, and then we'll open it up for a few questions if we have those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ramona Kennedy, and I'm the Chief Clerk and Parliamentarian for the House of Representatives. The rules you find before you are the rules, a model set that has been used over the past sessions for joint committees. They are not unlike the Ways and Means Committees. They're not unlike what we have just adopted in the Emergency Preparedness and Ocean Policy Committees, and they're not unlike rules that have been adopted in past sessions all the way from tort reform to other joint committees that have had both Senate and House members meet And with the proviso, and it was really set up in the spirit of allowing measures to come through this entire committee, knowing that once the decision is made, that it would then come through the second chamber, and that it would be processed not unlike the Ways and Means process, where that they would come in for the signature of the other co-chair and come to the floor for a vote. And that's what you have before you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to open up for any questions that any of the representatives or senators have, and we'll start with Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kennedy, this session, we have seen a new change to the committee dealing with the majorities required to pass measures or motions. Isn't that correct with joint committees, that now a majority of members from each chamber is required rather than just a majority member of the committee?
In the joint committees that we have had previously, Senator Beyer, Mr. Co-Chair, these are not different than what we've had in the past. We've set up two different types of joint committees. There has been the situation where you might have where a Senate, and I'll just use this as an example, the Senate Revenue Committee might meet with the House Revenue Committee for purposes of receiving testimony, but the bill that has been referred from the appropriate chamber is then taken up in work session only by that portion of that dynamic, in that if it was a House bill, it would be heard and voted on, be heard in a public hearing by both committees, but only voted on by the House committee. And then that process would be the same on the Senate side. Any joint committee we have set up, Senator Beyer, has been done with the rules you find before you, where it is a majority of each chamber, and that was put into place basically back in early 2000s, when there was a decision made by leadership at that time that Ways and Means should clearly be a vote from each chamber as opposed to a majority of the entire committee. And that's a practice that we've followed since then.
Further question, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Just for the record then, for purposes of a quorum for discussion issues that will be in front of this committee, members of the full committee, so need to be, or six members need to make a quorum, so members, the five Senate members could get together and discuss issues that are in front of this committee, and it would not be a quorum of the committee?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that is correct for the purposes of one chamber cannot make a decision without the other chamber. So if five members from the Senate want to get together and have a conversation about that, they cannot take action separate from the House. Therefore, they don't then violate the quorum rules.
Further question, Mr. Chair? Number 14, dealing with minority reports, I think the language reads pretty clearly. I just want you to clarify that these rules do not allow minority reports to come out of this committee.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Beyer, that is correct. No minority reports will be allowed out of this committee. And that is not unlike the rules, again, that we've had before other joint committees that are set up and structured like this committee.
Any other questions?
No, it's going to be for me.
Okay. Any other questions? Any questions from any of the members from the House? If not, then the chair will entertain a motion for the adoption of the proposed committee rules that are before us.
Chair, I would move the adoption of the rules as presented.
Senator, excuse me. I'm sorry. Senator Johnson has just moved the proposed rules for the Joint Committee on Land Use Fairness. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's pretty clear what number 14 states, and I believe that is not appropriate for a policy committee. Policy committees, the way dissenting members have the option traditionally to get their issues to the floor and to be debated are to be able to issue minority reports out of the committees. I understand that there's tradition for the budget committees in this building, but I don't think it's appropriate for a policy committee. I will not support the rules that have that because of that reason. I think that, fairness to minority members, and that's their opportunity to get an issue to the floor. And without that opportunity in a policy, you have no opportunity. So I think it's inappropriate. I think it's unfortunate. I think it's a departure of traditional Senate practices, at least while I've been in the Senate, to have policy issues allowed with minority reports to go to the floor of the Senate. And I think that this committee should change that rule and allow
minority reports in order that all of our voices potentially could be heard on the floor. And I think the same for the House.
All right. Appreciate your comments. Any other comments? Senator George.
Yeah, addressing Rule 14, I just want to also add that these rules concern me because of that. It seems like from last week when we had just a Senate committee on this to where we are now that the minority is in a dramatically different place. And if it would be possible for the committee to consider redrafting Rule 14 to allow minority reports, that'd be very much appreciated.
Any other comments? Not hearing any. I appreciate the comments from both Senator George and Senator Beyer. It sounds from what Ms. Kennedy has told us, it appears that we are in compliance with what the rules are, not only that were adopted for the Ways and Means, but also for the other joint committee that's meeting this cycle. And accordingly, we'll go ahead and take a vote, and we'll see how the vote goes, and from there we'll take the next step. For all those in favor, we're going to do a roll call vote on this, please. In favor of adopting the rules as proposed for the Joint Committee on Land Use Fairness, will answer aye, and those against, opposed, will say no.
Senator Beyer?
No.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
No.
Senator George?
No.
Senator Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Senator Prater?
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Chair, co-chair votes aye, and the rules are adopted. All right, we're moving into what is now at this point is an informational meeting, and I do want to point out that there's a possibility, we're not sure exactly, for next Tuesday. I did make an announcement that our meetings will normally be 5 to 7. There's a possibility of one or two things that could be happening. At this point, we have tentatively set that meeting to start at 6:30 because there's a conflict for a number of the members prior to that time. But please stay tuned because that could also be subject to change. With that, we're going into the informational meeting. This meeting will be hearing from invited testimony from Lane Chatterley. And I'm going to ask Lane, I'm not sure, do you want to bring a panel up at the same time? Okay. And Mr. Treffler, if you'll come up as well. And if you're ready to start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lane Chatterley, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I'm here with Stephanie Striffler from the Department of Justice. Our purpose this evening between the two of us is to lay out for you just a factual basis of where we stand in the state with respect to ballot measure 37 claims and litigation. I think you have also on the agenda tonight Arch Schlack to address Measure 37 on the county front at the local government level, and also Sheila Martin from Portland State University, who has information from the Portland State University Measure 37 database, which is probably the most extensive source of information on county and state claims, as well as city claims. And so I think that the information you get this evening should give you a good foundation of information and knowledge about the measure and where we stand today. I've distributed to you written testimony. I intend to use it only for an outline of my comments. I will not read the information, but I do want to take you through just what the attachments are so that you have a good roadmap to what we're looking at. There's the testimony itself. Following the testimony, for your information, so you have it before you, is attachment A, which is the official ballot title and explanatory statement for Measure 37. That is a two-page exhibit. Following that, you have a series of pages that set forth Measure 37 claim statistics. One is a page just aided with narrative recitation of the numbers of claims and information as of December 4. We'll talk about the significance of that date.
Thank you.
Then you have a chart that shows the, it's a graph, a bar chart that shows information about the claims received from July through the first part of December. Following that is a processing schedule for ballot measure 37 claims. It's another way to look at the record of claims filed and how they would move through the process to decision based on the 180-day timeline under the measure. Then information from a Measure 37 claim survey. I won't spend any time on that. It's county information, and you'll get that from Mr. Schlack, but it's part of our record, and so I wanted to have that with my testimony. And then following the claims information, you have selected maps of counties that have some of the most significant Measure 37 claims activity, beginning with Hood River County.
Yeah,
and I should indicate, and the legend appears on that map, that the red indicates the location of ballot Measure 37 claims. Gray on that map shows public lands, which, of course, are significant in a number of counties, including Hood River County. Second map you have is Washington County, again with red, showing the location of ballot measure 37 claims graphically. Next is a measure 37 claim application map from Clackamas County. It has its own legend, which is a little bit more extensive than the legends that we have from Hood River and Washington counties. Then a Jackson County map, just to indicate that there's an activity, of course, in the southern part of the state as well. It's got its own legend for the claims. And then finally, a metro area Measure 37 claim map, just really with dots that indicate the location of the claims. Not quite as informative as some of the other maps that actually identify the claims by size. So with that, then, Mr. Chair, what I would like to do is just briefly lay, a foundation of common knowledge about the measure for the committee as you begin your deliberation. The measure goes back to November 2 of 2004, when it was approved by the voters by a margin of about 61% to 39%. And generally what it says is that government has to compensate private property owners for land use regulations that restrict the use of their property and by that restriction thereby reduce its value. What's critical in that summation of the measure is the date of acquisition of the property by the claimant, because the regulations for which a claim may be made are regulations enacted after the claimant acquired title or an interest in the property. When those regulations restrict the use and thereby reduce its value. If a claim is valid under the ballot measure, government has the option, in lieu of paying compensation, to modify, remove, or not apply the regulation or regulations on which the claim is based. In our parlance, we'll refer to that as waiver. You'll not find waiver in ballot measure 37, but that's the common terminology, and so we will use that. The measure refers to modifying, removing, or not applying, but we refer to it as waiver. Also under the measure, if government does not act within 180 days from the date that a demand for compensation is received, then the claimant is given a right under the measure to bring an action against the government for compensation plus attorney fees and costs in that case. The measure does include exemptions, that is, regulations that would be exempt from claims under the measure. And those include laws that restrict, and it's a phrase in the measure, commonly and historically recognized public nuisances, public health and safety regulations, regulations that are required to comply with federal law, and regulations that restrict the use of property for the purpose of selling pornography or performing nude dancing. Regulations that fall within that universe are exempt from the measure and do not give rise to a claim either for compensation or for waiver. As we all know, and Representative Girard and Representative Smith, who we spent a lot of time together last session, they know very well, as I know you all do, there was no money appropriated either through the measure or subsequently by the legislature to pay compensation, and so we have not paid any of the claims that have come to the state. And to my knowledge, Not a single county or city at this point has paid a Measure 37 claim for compensation. There was discussion about payment in the city of Prineville. I think that has not gone forward. So to my knowledge, I believe I'm accurate today that there has been no claims paid. Instead, all claims have that have been determined valid have gone to waiver. There are several drafting and other legal issues around the measure that have resulted in part in a host of litigation. Ms. Driffler from the Department of Justice will walk you through those cases. I think we're in excess of 130 cases right now, statewide, involving claims or involving the measure. So you know, we are so far proceeding on a rule of thumb that somewhere between 5 and 7% of all claim decisions will mature to some form of litigation. And we're seeing litigation filed both by disappointed claimants and by neighbors of successful claimants. And so it makes my job, it makes me zen about my work, knowing that we stand to be sued almost no matter which decision we make. And it is true that you'll find litigation coming at us from both directions. But it does indicate, I think, a substantial degree of uncertainty about the measure. Some of the key issues are identified on page 2 of my testimony. The first bullet really encapsulates the question of transferability, whether when a claimant is granted a waiver, whether that claimant is entitled to convey the property to another owner, and whether that succeeding owner then can proceed to implement the waiver and under what circumstances. Valuation is an ongoing issue in implementing the measure. That is, how is government supposed to determine what kind of standards are supposed to be used in determining whether a regulation has reduced the value of the property? And apart from the legal and policy implications, how is that supposed to be done within the 180-day time frame that is provided in the measure for arriving at a determination? We see in the third bullet, it's not uncommon where claimants come forward with claims where it's not entirely clear what it is they intend to do with the property. The ballot measure talks about a waiver being granted to allow the claimant a use of the property that was permitted when the claimant acquired their interest in the property. And that is a constant source of iterative contact between my department and claimants as we seek to ascertain what their intent is so that we can fashion a waiver when a claim is valid that is functional so the claimant can then take that waiver and actually turn it into a development proposal. And then another issue happens where we have a waiver that results essentially in a waiver of some things complained of but not all things complained of. Does that give the claimant a right to bring an action for damages against government, or is the review under the Administrative Procedures Act for the court to determine the correctness of the agency's decision? These and other issues will be further described by Ms. Striffler, but I think it just brings home the point that there are very significant legal issues still today, 2 years and a couple of months after the adoption of the measure, that remain to be resolved. So you know, I want to describe briefly the claims process. The measure says that regulations adopted by the state and adopted by county and by city and by metro are regulations against which or on which claims may be brought. At the state, we identified early on the Department of Administrative Services to function as the gatekeeper, the receiving agent for all claims coming into the state. That was done for a couple of reasons. If you think about it again into the measure, these claims come in as demands for compensation. The Department of Administrative Services is the risk management agency for the state, serves that function. And it also recognizes the fact that claims may come in against the state based on regulations adopted not only by my department, the Department of Land Conservation and Development, or by statutes that we administer, but also may come in and implicate claims against regulations or statutes through the Department of Forestry, Department of Transportation, Department of State Lands. We see other agencies represented in the claims that come in So the Department of Administrative Services serves that function as the central receiving place, and then part of that claims processing involves the assignment of the claim out to the agency or agencies whose regulations are implicated by the nature of the claim. So DAS receives the claim from claimants. DAS does a number of things at the front end. They do initial intake. They enter the claims into the database. So that we have a record of the claims, of the property, of the nature, of the use, to the extent that it can be determined, and other critical information that we then use to track the claims through the process and develop a record of claims. DAS also performs a critical function in that they contact the local counties from which these claims are coming, because under the state rules, while we do not conduct hearings on claims, we do provide notice to neighboring property owners and an opportunity for neighboring property owners to comment on the claim as it is in process. So DAS then makes the contact out to each county and works with the counties to get a record of names and addresses of the neighboring property owners so that a letter can be sent to advise those neighbors that a claim has been filed and inform them of their rights under the state process to submit written comments that would be considered in our review of the claim. The Department of Justice also works in partnership with this because other early steps that occur include a review of the title to the property to help determine the date on which the claimant acquired an interest in the property. Sounds straightforward, but I can tell you that's become one of the most problematic aspects of claim determination, review of title. I've practiced law for 23 years, and a good part of it was involved in real estate, and I'm surprised even after that to see the state of title that you have on a lot of properties, and it takes a good bit of work in many cases to ferret out the nature of interests in these titles so that we can determine who is the owner of the property, when did the owner acquire that interest, because, again, that's critical in making a determination of the claim. The Department of Justice also has a checklist basically for essential legal issues that they're involved in early on, and then in all of this process at the front end, a determination is made just what agency is responsible for the regulation being complained of. In many cases, that's pretty clear. It's not always clear. We do not require a specific recitation by a claimant of a statute or administrative rule. If they can express what the nature of the regulation and their intended use is, we will do our best to make that determination for them. But in most cases, it's pretty clear, and in most cases, I'm saying about 98% of the cases, those claims do come eventually to my department for determination under either the statutes that we administer, typically Chapter 215, governing uses on farm and forest lands, or under the statewide land use planning goals, or under the administrative rules adopted by the Land Conservation and Development Commission, and typically a combination of all three of those. Some claims may implicate more than one agency's regulations, and in that case, DAS designates a lead agency, and then we work together so that each agency is responsible for its own review, but then the claim is coordinated for the purpose of issuing a final report. When the claim makes its way to my department after it's been through the notice process, checklist, ownership, my staff does essentially the substantive evaluation of the claim. We look at what regulations were in effect on the date that the owner acquired the property. There's often contact between my people and county to make sure that we're understanding the zoning in place on property and what uses would have been permitted under county zoning. We do an analysis of the claim. We issue ultimately after Department of Justice review, and each one of these is reviewed because each one potentially could ripen into a substantial claim for liability against the state. So we're very careful about our work product. But eventually, in this process, within the 180-day timeline, we prepare a draft report that indicates the full analysis of the claim. It indicates a recommended determination. That draft report then goes out to the claimant, to the local government, and to anybody else who submitted comments to the claims process. They all have 10 days within which to review and respond with information either to correct any factual errors or to take issue with legal analysis that may have gone into the evaluation of the claim. Those comments are considered, and then a final report and order are issued always within the 180 days. And that is the claims process. That's the state claims process, and this gets down to the next. I should mention that at this point we have a Measure 37 claims division in my department that did not exist 2 years ago. I think we have 12 people working full-time on Measure 37 claims review. I should make clear that that does not describe the full extent of my department's involvement in the Measure 37 claims review. In fact, everybody in my department whose position is not limited by fund type, typically federal funds, and in some cases, a couple of cases, other funds, is involved in Measure 37. That includes our field staff, that includes our specialists, farm and forest and urban specialists. And so it has been very much an all-hands-on-deck proposition during these past couple of years moving these claims through. Again, I mentioned this describes the state process. There is a local government component as well. And I'll describe how state and locals have coordinated on this. Your typical ballot Measure 37 claim is a claim that comes in on resource land, that is rural land that's zoned either farm or forest or occasionally farm forest. That's your most typical claim. And in those zones and on those lands, you have a layering of regulation. You have the state statutes and goals and administrative rules. And underneath those state statutes, goals and administrative rules, you have the county comprehensive plan and county zoning ordinance that, of course, was adopted to implement the state land use planning program. But they're born of separate jurisdictional authority. Counties have adopted their own comprehensive plan, their own zoning ordinances. The state has its administrative rules, goals, and statutes. It has been understood, certainly as best practice, and we did get a legal decision out of a case in Jackson County that supported that general understanding of best practice from the beginning. And I should mention this Jackson County case came out just last Friday that affirmed at the trial court level our interpretation.
Pardon?
Oh, you did. Thank you. Ms. Trifler has that decision for you. We've taken the position, and again, it's generally agreed upon, that the state has authority to waive state statutes, regulations, and counties and local governments have authority to waive theirs, and it doesn't go crosswise. And so your typical claim involves a claim by a property owner filed with the county, seeking and making a demand based on county regulations, and at the same time, if they're doing if it's working just the best, file a claim with the state so that they can obtain relief or make a claim against the state regulations. There has been a substantial amount of sharing of information back and forth, as I mentioned, between counties and state. And ultimately, what a property owner gets is a determination by the state and a determination by the county. Again, in this typical claim involving a resource land claim. And at the end of that, then, what they are in a position to do is to take those waivers, now the county waiver and the state waiver, hoping and assuming that in most cases they do, sync up. They go to the county planning department and say, I have my waivers from the state, I have my waiver from the county. They determine that I acquired an interest in the property in 1977. That establishes the date on which my rights of use of the property accrue, and then file a claim for development based on those laws that exist in 1977, let's say in that scenario. What we've seen then in the way of ballot measure 37, you may have heard me describe it, but I think the effect of it statewide has been to create a system of what I call property-specific land use time zones, so that every property in the state exists in a time zone for regulatory purposes, and that time zone is determined according to the date that the claimant acquired their interest in the property. You may have neighboring properties virtually identical, but they may be subject to completely different sets of regulations depending now on the dates on which the current owner of the property acquired their interest in that property. And so that's our purpose in reviewing a Measure 37 claim, to determine that date of acquisition, what laws applied, what laws since then have restricted the use and thereby reduced the value and should be waived, and then give them the ability to proceed then with development based on the law that's determined to apply. I'll finish up here with just describing the number of claims. I think you'll get most of this information from Sheila Martin. I think she can present it more graphically than I can. I will turn to page 9 of my testimony. It's the State Measure 37 claim statistics attached as part of Attachment B. This refers to December 4, the state having received approximately 6,500 claims. What's important to know about that number is, first of all, it's not fixed. We find that even as DAS is going through those claims, that in some cases several claims were actually attached together, and as DAS unbundles them through the intake process, we find that what appeared to be one claim may actually be several claims, and so that's why these numbers are still approximate. Of that 6,500 or so, you will see the breakdown there that fully half of those, 3,309, were received between November 17 and December 4. That's a huge influx of claims that is fairly graphically expressed on the bar chart on the back of that, that shows that period of claims as we got toward the December 4 date. What was critical about December 4 is a change in the process under ballot measure 37. It contained a provision in the measure that said basically that for the first 2 years, the threshold for filing a claim was going to be very low, and all we interpreted it to mean would be a requirement that a claimant would show that they could have done something before that they can't do now with their property. That was good enough to constitute the basis for a claim. After December 4, under the measure, claimants, if they're going to base their claims based on regulations that were enacted before the measure took effect, are required to go through a complete land use process at the county level or the local government level, and have their land use applications determined, have the county or local government grant a denial or perhaps condition the approval on certain regulations, and then and only then can the claimant come forward to the state and say, based on the outcome of my application to the county, I believe I have a claim against the state for regulations that are restricting the use of my property, as evidenced by the county's determination. That's a higher threshold. It means that claimants are going to have to prepare and file and go through the local government county planning process, and that will cost money. It will take time. And I think as a consequence of that, knowing that that change was coming, that's why we saw the influx of claims coming into December 4. Claimants were aware that that was coming. And, in fact, we've seen a substantial drop-off in claims ever since then. So these numbers reflecting as of December 4 are largely the picture of claims that we have even still today, because very little has happened on the claims front since then. As you can see, I'll just come down to showing the number of claims at the Department of Land Conservation and Development as of that time. 2,239 of the claims had been referred to DLCD. That number would be higher because the claims processing has continued even after December 4, but that general breakdown between DLCD and other agencies is remaining true, with, again, my agency representing by far the majority of all claims. As of that date, about 1,603 final orders had been issued. We're pushing closer to 2,000 by now, in the way of final orders issued by the state. I think I'll move on quickly and wrap up here. I want to call your attention to this processing schedule for remaining ballot 37, that measure 37 claims. That shows graphically the bulge through the snake, if you will, that my department and DOJ and the Department of Administrative Services would have to get through if we were going to actually process all of these claims within the 180 days provided in the measure. I can tell you that based on these numbers, it's not going to happen with our current staffing. You can see there's a week out there in the end of May that we would be having to put, I'm sorry, 1st of June, putting out 2,334 final orders in 1 week. recognizing that, as you can see, backing up from there, there are a lot of steps that have to occur in order to get a claim to that point. It's a remarkable graphic here, but clearly beyond staffing levels between the three agencies to accommodate the 180-day time frame on these numbers. And I think you'll hear largely the same story from Mr. Schlack from the counties. They're facing the same situation that we are. Lastly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just call your attention to the maps. These are graphic representations of the claims that have been filed in those counties to date. I think Sheila Martin may have some more current statewide numbers, but I thought that picture being worth a thousand words, that these maps would at least help to portray the extent of claims in these representative counties and in the metropolitan area to give you a sense of what we're talking about on the ground. Mr. Chair, I think I'll stop at that. I know you have other witnesses to get through, and I hope that's a useful foundation anyway. I'm happy to answer questions either now or at any point you want to take them.
Yeah, I think what we're going to do is first we're going to go ahead and have you address any questions we may have. I'll ask you to stand there at the dais. After we finish the others, see if there's any follow-up. But instead of waiting, I know that committee members have been very patient in getting the presentation. So we'll open it up for any questions anyone may have. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have three or four questions. Lane, I guess if I have you start by define interest therein as it's used in the Measure 37 and 197-352.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Beyer, with the able assistance of my lawyer. So I used to be a lawyer. Now I'm a client, so I can do that. The state's position on interest therein modifies property so that we're talking in code here. The measure defines owner. I think that's where you're getting this from, the definition of owner of the property as the present owner of the property or any interest therein. And we have interpreted interest therein to modify property. So we're talking about somebody who has an interest in the property.
Okay.
Is that correct, Madam Counsel?
May I?
If you'll just identify yourself for the record so we have that on there.
Thank you. Stephanie Striffler, Special Counsel to the Attorney General. I would add to what Director Shetterly said that interest therein also relates in the definition of owner to the rest of the measure, which has to do with what restrictions give somebody a qualifying claim under Measure 37. So in order to have a qualifying claim under Measure 37, an owner has to have an interest that has been restricted by a land use regulation in a way that reduces the fair market value of that owner's interest.
Okay, I guess a follow-up would be maybe something. Is there a definition someplace in statute that would define that verbiage as it's been used in other places prior to this measure?
Of interest therein?
Yes.
I don't think so, again, because it's used in the context of the rest of the language of Measure 37. We look at it in the context of the rest of the language of the measure.
Further question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. You mentioned the 180 days and this deadline looming, but what does the measure really say will happen at 180 days? You said the plain text says that they could file a action in court and get attorney's fees or something like that if they win. But what does that really mean to you and to the counties? I mean, that's not a drop dead date that if you don't take action, that the regulation is automatically waived, does it? And could the claimants voluntarily waive or extend that if they were asked to do so without changing the statute?
Mr. Chair, Representative Senator Beyer, let me kind of take the last question first. I believe a claimant could voluntarily waive, extend the time limit under the measure. Frankly, we have discouraged claimants from doing that. We're processing 6,500 claims, and it helps us in our processing if we have them all marching along the same timeline and not a variety of dates based on individual claims. In terms of the risk to the state, I think we see the risk as being liability the day we go beyond 180, if we do not make a decision on the claim. It is not clear under the measure that after 180 days that we have the authority to waive a statute and thereby alleviate or resolve a claim for liability for not having resolved the claim within 180 days. So for us, we see that as a very bright line and very clear and very serious line of liability that we need in all cases to avoid, because again, I think whatever happens after that date is largely under the control of the claimant and leaves the state fully exposed to the extent of liability that they may wish to assert.
Okay, further question?
Yes.
This question, you probably have to get back to me, but you did say that the number of claims has significantly dropped off since December 4th. Could you get us what the numbers have been since then? You probably don't have it with you.
But no, I don't, but I sure can. You bet.
And then the final question, I think you handed out this chart, and now I can't find it, of course, because I've got so many charts, but I think you handed that one out to us, didn't you? On the back and by county, you have listed total number of claims after November 1st, and then a category which I'm trying to figure out how you describe as a timber company submitting claims. Could you tell me what...
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, if I may, I'll defer to Art Schlack. That's actually AOC's schedule. I just put it in as part of our testimony for the county breakdown. But Mr. Schlack prepared that, and he's up tonight, so you can ask him what that means and how they derived that.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right. Other questions from members?
Yeah. Mr. Co-Chair, if I could.
You bet.
Yeah, Mr. Shetterly, I want to make sure I'm understanding the numbers on the claims that are pending. There's 6,500 claims approximately that have been made to the state, and that includes those are all claims made to the state, whether it implicates regulations of other agencies in LCDCs.
Right.
And then the approximately 7,000 that we see on the county schedule, that's in addition to the state claims. Is that right?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair McPherson. not in addition to. Again, keep in mind that your typical claimant is somebody who owns property out in a rural part of a county whose use is implicated by county regulation as well as by state regulations. That property will have a county claim and a state claim. And so you don't want to aggregate the state number plus the county numbers. There should be, they should be close. Now, we believe that they're not for a couple of reasons. Some claimants just did not file claims both with the state and with the counties. Not all counties were consistent in encouraging claimants to do that. And so we believe that there are some claims out there for which claims have been filed at the county level, but we have not yet received any state claims. Also, there are some city claims included in our number. We've received claims that have been based on regulations enacted within urban growth boundaries and sometimes even within city limits that may not also be reflected in that county number. So it's difficult to know the total, and Sheila Martin may have a better sense than I, but it's going to be a while before we are able to tell you the exact total. It's going to be somewhere around that 6,500 to 7,000 properties, if you think about it in terms of properties as opposed to claims, because each property may have two claims. So it's really in that ballpark of between 6,500 and 7,000 properties that have claims currently.
Okay. Do you have any sense about what the overlap would be? If we were talking about total number of claims, would it be then, and maybe you're not in a position to say that, but is it likely then 8,000? Because there's some overlap, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair McPherson, yeah, there very well could be. If you assume that some claims came into the state that also did not go to the county, by the time you put those together, there may be a total increase in the claims. My gut tells me it's not as high as 8,000. I don't think we're missing that many. I think 7,000 is probably a good benchmark when it comes down to it in terms of where we are, at least as of this December 4 deadline. If you want to peg a number, I'd put it statewide in terms of properties on which claims have been made. 7,000 is probably a pretty good benchmark.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Clem, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Church, thank you. I think I'm seeing how this works on the two fact sheets that we have, one from Portland Metropolitan Studies and your own, and you've got a, prior to November 17th, $6 billion worth of compensation requested, 200,000 acres. After November 17th, if you go to this sheet, over $10 billion in 500,000 acres. So 300,000 plus acres, $4 billion in the last few months, essentially.
Yes, and thank you for that, Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Clem. That's why I said that Sheila Martin's numbers may be more current than ours. DAS is doing the intake process, of course, very methodically, because as they do it, they're doing the data entry, they're sending out the notices to the claimants, and they are still working through the in-basket. For their purposes of claims that came in, before the December deadline. I think Sheila will tell you from PSU that they've been able to send students and other people working to basically go through and get ahead of us, because they're only looking for certain information and not doing the kind of work that DAS is doing with each of those claims. So they've been able to take a sneak peek at the information and claims that DAS has not gotten to yet that wouldn't be reflected in our numbers. So I think ours eventually will catch up to theirs as the state does the data entry.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lane, I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked you the other morning in Ways and Means, and that is, based with your present staff, how long into the future till you had processed all claims?
Co-chairs, Representative Garrard, and my answer is the same, of course, that we've calculated that based on current budget and staffing levels, and that includes not only our Measure 37 division, but also continuing to use our non-Measure 37 staff, if we're looking at about an 18-month period to process claims, going back to probably the last week or so in October. That is, if you were to take claims filed in that last week in October, that's when the bulge really started to step up. We're looking at about 18 months to get all those claims moved through the process based on current staffing levels. That is, taking into account DAS's staffing, DOJ staffing, and our staffing. As I also mentioned, there's a hydraulic there that as you add more staffing, you can shorten that time frame, although there's a practical limit. At this point, these are limited duration positions. It's not an expertise that exists in a marketplace out there with people looking for work. And frankly, it's difficult to fill these positions. We've got an excellent team of folks working on Measure 37 right now, but we've had to work hard to get these positions because they are limited duration, and they just, you don't have any college majors graduating with degrees in Measure 37 claims review looking for work. And so we've got lawyers, we've got planners, we've got an environmental biologist, and other folks who come from risk management, all of them doing this.
Follow, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
During the interim, the E-Board granted your agency additional money for additional staff for these claims. When does that authorization expire in regards to your 18-month out?
Co-chairs, Representative Garrard, that authorization expires at the end of the biennium. Again, being limited duration, they all expire on June 30. And so we'll have to be, authorization will have to be renewed in the budget for the coming biennium.
Thank you. Any other questions, Mr. Farr? Representative Clem?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also serve on the same subcommittee, and there was a figure, if I remember right, in the governor's recommended budget for something like 16 additional positions, and it was a $3 to $4 million. I don't remember the price tag, but sort of the price tag of those positions, and is that to be at 18 months, or did those $3 or $4 million buy us some time backwards?
Thank you, co-chairs, Representative Klim. The number in the governor's recommended budget, I believe, for Measure 37 is $4.5 million. That's for staffing, but also for litigation, which is not a necessarily a staffing-related expense. It is for you. That 4.5 was derived, if you go back in budget preparation, that really reflects where we thought we were probably last summer.
Right.
It does not reflect the end-of-the-year spike, and so that 4.5 really is the current staffing number that I'm talking about. And it's not 16 new positions. That's basically, since, again, there's a limited duration positions, mm-hmm. they look new because they have to be reauthorized from zero for the new biennium.
So, follow Mr. Chair, just so I got it right, $4.5 million that's in the governor's plan would arrive at about 18 months to process all these.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Shetterly at this point? If not, thank you very much.
Thank
you. Stay there just in case there's something else that comes up. And is it Ms. Strifler?
Strifler,
please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, Stephanie Strifler, special counsel to the Attorney General. I'm going to give a quick overview of where we are on litigation and then focus on some of the specific issues that are in litigation. What we've provided you in terms of handouts are three. One is a copy of the Jackson County case that Mr. Shetterly mentioned, just because that's been in the press and we thought you might be interested to have a copy. Also, we've provided a printout from the Department of Justice website, which is a list of all the pending Measure 37 cases that we have in our office, which we update regularly, although it's not completely up to date today as we hand it to you. And on the website, we also provide copies of briefs that we filed in those cases, and then if there are opinions issued in those cases, we post them on the website as well. And then the other handout is a summary of significant issues that are currently pending in litigation, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. As Mr. Shetterly mentioned, we all started down this road together in implementing Measure 37, knowing that there were significant uncertainties in how Measure 37 would be applied and how the courts would interpret it. So that's what these over 130 cases are dealing with, is those uncertainties that really could be resolved only through litigation. We have over 130 cases. There are basically three kinds of cases. Two kinds relate to claims. They are cases brought by claimants who don't like the action that the state agencies took on their claim. And then there is another kind of claims litigation, and those are cases brought by neighbors who don't like the relief that the state has provided to their neighbors. And then there are also a small number of cases in which the state has participated in order to clarify how Measure 37 applies to local government actions. And again, that Jackson County case would be an example of that. That was a case where Jackson County had an ordinance directing had an order directing county planners that Measure 37 waivers were transferable and that permits should be issued without the county necessarily looking to the applicability of state law and without looking at whether there was a state waiver also. So that case was brought by Jackson County, but we participated in order to make the state's views known about the interaction between Measure 37 and pre-existing state land use laws. In terms of potential liability, and this follows up on a question I believe Senator Beyer asked, in terms of the cases that we've seen, Measure 37 provides for damages, attorney fees, and costs if a claimant prevails. And the total amount of compensation that's requested in pending litigation right now is over $350 million. So that's a percentage, of course, of the amount that's requested in claims. That's because a percentage of of cases go to litigation. We, at this point, do not have any cases that have gone to a final judgment ordering payment of compensation by the state. And that's because on the cases where we have not prevailed, we are still in the appellate process. A very fiscally significant issue that's not yet resolved in Measure 37 litigation is what happens when a claimant successfully challenges a state agency order. Generally, claimants argue that there should be more regulations waived than the agency waived. And the question is whether, if a court agrees with the claimant that the order was an error, does the agency get a chance to fix that order and comply with the court's ruling, or does the court have authority to award compensation at that point? So we do not yet know what the ultimate answer to that question will be. That's a big question mark out there. We have been successful in obtaining decisions from county circuit courts on a large number of the significant issues about the interpretation of Measure 37. And Mr. Shetterly referred to his Zen experience of knowing he'll get sued no matter what. We're happy to report that the vast majority of cases we have prevailed, and the state's decision on the Measure 37 claim has been upheld, whether it's been attacked by the claimant or by a neighbor. Some trial court rulings we've received conflict with each other, and that's something I want to emphasize. Although we have a large number of trial court decisions, we are just starting down the appellate phase of litigation. And, of course, it will not be until we get ultimate appellate court rulings on these issues that there will be decisions on the interpretation of Measure 37 that will be binding statewide. So despite the fact that we have a large number of circuit court decisions, there remains significant uncertainty about the issues that we started out with uncertainty about 2 years ago. Moving to the specific issues that are in litigation, and that's the handout that says major issues pending. Let me emphasize these are not all of the potential issues that may be out there or that are in complaints that have been filed. These are the issues that are now being briefed or at a point where a court has heard them. And these are only cases in which the state is involved. So this handout does not tell you anything about cases involving local governments, and there are a lot of those also. A first huge question for the state with respect to Measure 37 orders is what is the means for challenging a Measure 37 order? And as you're aware, the Administrative Procedures Act generally governs state agency orders. So that's been the question, whether that pre-existing general statute that addresses how state agency orders gets reviewed should apply under Measure 37. And there's two pages of cases listed here in which we have raised that issue, and we got to a tipping point where we determined that in order to get fast resolution of that issue or faster resolution of that issue, we needed to file a mandamus petition in the Oregon Supreme Court. So that is the Griffiths case that is mentioned on the handout. So there are a couple related questions there. One is, does the Administrative Procedures Act apply? Do rules under the Administrative Procedures Act apply generally to judicial review of state agency orders under Measure 37? And then one way that that issue comes up is that under the APA, there is a 60-day deadline for filing a challenge of agency orders. And so then does that 60-day deadline apply? So those are issues that we are hoping to get resolution from the Oregon Supreme Court soon. Some of the other issues have come up in Mr. Shetterly's testimony. On page 3 of the handout, we talk about transferability.
As Mr. Shetterly said, that's a big issue. That's addressed in the Jackson County case that we handed out, and it was also previously addressed in a similar case in Crook County. Now, the Crook County case was not appealed, so there's an example of where we have a ruling, but because that wasn't appealed, we don't yet have a ruling that is binding statewide. And there are a few other cases that raise that issue. Another major issue, as Mr. Shetterly said,
I wanted to leave it something.
Oh, okay, thanks. A huge issue, and one that we've talked about since the beginning of Measure 37, was whether state agencies have the authority to waive state statutes. And that issue comes up because Measure 37 in Section 8 of the measure talks about the governing body responsible for enacting the regulation being able to waive the regulation. Well, the argument is, state agencies, DLCD, LCDC, are not agencies that enacted state statutes, so how do they have authority to waive state statutes? Does only the legislature have that authority? And we have had that issue come up in one major case. That's a series of cases that we asked to be consolidated in Marion County Circuit Court for purposes of addressing this and other issues. And the Marion County Circuit Court in the Hood River Valley Residence Committee and Vanderzanden cases did say that state agencies have authority to waive state statutes. And I will spare you the theory under which that got them there. On page 4, we talk about another major issue that you may be familiar with, which is the question of there are two different dates under Measure 37, the date that's used to determine how compensation would be arrived at if state agencies were to provide compensation, or a different date, which is used to determine what regulations are looked at in terms of providing a waiver. And that's based on the language of Measure 37. And in the Cobos case in Marion County, the court did say that those were two different dates, although there continue to be challenges to that issue. Again, the Cobos decision was not appealed. The Olson case noted below, there is an appeal on that case, and so we may get an appellate court ruling on that. Mr. Shetterly also mentioned valuation issues. I've listed a couple of them here, but basically there are a lot of questions about what is the kind and quantum of evidence that state agencies are required to or entitled to look at in order to determine whether the regulation at issue has reduced the fair market value of the property. And we have gotten answers to some of those questions, again, from Marion County in the Hood River and Vanderzanden cases. And that case did determine that the methodology that the state is currently using, under which as Mr. Shetterly said, the state is not providing compensation. So in those instances, we have said the agencies don't need to figure out what the exact reduction in fair market value is. They don't need to enter into a detailed valuation analysis. The question before the agencies is whether there has been any reduction in value at all. And the Marion County Circuit Court agreed with us that that was a valid analysis under Measure 37. Another question, and this one you did mention also, was the necessity of a state waiver, and I think we've talked about that issue also in the Jackson County case, and that's the only decision that we have on that issue. The next one I mentioned is the federal requirements exception. One of the very first cases that we had and the very first case to get to the appellate level was a question of whether the Columbia Gorge Scenic Area Act, whether county ordinances adopted to implement the Columbia Gorge Scenic Area Act, whether those were exempt from Measure 37, because Measure 37 provides an exemption for regulations that are required to comply with federal law. And that case was argued last month in the Oregon Court of Appeals on appeal of a Hood River County decision holding that those regulations are exempt from Measure 37. The Notch cases, those are a series of cases that involve delving into the history of land use in Oregon. As we said, in order to determine a claim, it's necessary to look at what regulations were affected the property at the time that it was acquired. And there's been some question about the status of state law before local land use plans were acknowledged. And so that's the issue that's been at issue in the cases mentioned under number 11. And so far the courts have agreed with us that state land use planning laws, in particular certain goals, applied directly before land use plans were acknowledged. And so claimants can't simply rely on the date of the acknowledgement of the land use plan in making their Measure 37 claim. Then I will conclude by saying that there are a variety of issues related to ownership, and that variety has been surprising and astounding. But the basic question is, who is a qualifying owner under Measure 37, and what kind of interest does it take in order to have a valid claim under Measure 37, and when did that owner acquire the property? And there are a variety of questions involving trusts, revocable trusts, irrevocable trusts, land sale contracts, trust deeds, and the whole variety of ways in which folks can own and transfer property. I think that I'll leave that at that with the chair's permission.
Thank you, Ms. Treffler. Questions? Senator Schrader, was the valuation case appealed?
The time for appeal has not yet run, so we don't know yet.
Any other questions? We'll start with co-chair McPherson and then go down to Representative Clem.
Okay, Ms. Striffler, how long do you anticipate that if Measure 37 is not altered, the litigation that's on the issues that are being stirred up now will be pending? How long an undertaking are we looking at here?
We have tried to move these along as efficiently as possible under the circumstances, but I would say a case that has just started today could be 2 or 3 years before we get resolution. Cases that are just being appealed today, that depends on how long the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court takes. So that could be 1 to 3 years, 6 months to 3 years, maybe. It's hard to hard to make estimates about the appellate courts.
Okay. If another, if I could, Mr. Co-Chair, and who pays that the bill for the public entity's stake in that litigation, DOJ or counties? Where do the funds come from? Is it Mr. Shetterly's budget that has to provide for that?
Pretty much, yes. DOJ bills the lead agency who issued the order that is being challenged, so, which is generally Mr. Shetterly.
Co-Chair McPherson, that was my point in clarifying Representative Clem's question, that $4.5 million is not just staffing. A substantial part of that is litigation expense.
Right. Thank you. Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two quick questions, if I may. One, I think you said it, I missed it. On the case dealing with whether state agencies had the right to waive on behalf of the legislature, what was the state's position? What was the outcome?
We argued that state agencies have the authority to waive state statutes, and the court agreed with us.
Mr. Chair, And then the other piece, I just want to make sure I understand the implications if the 180 days can't be met. So if we start just with the December 4th, and forgetting anything before that, from December 4th through June 4th is 180 days, and I know you had a bunch to work on before that, those total around $4 billion. And the implication is automatic compensation of $4 billion to the claimants if there is no satisfactory answer, waivers, you know.
Representative Clem, what Measure 37 provides is that if the land use regulations still apply after 180 days, which is what happens if the agency has not acted, that there's a cause of action for compensation in circuit court. So it's not automatic in the sense that they don't just get to walk in and say, hand over the money. They do have to go to court, but it gives them a right to go to court for that, for compensation. And then presumably we would enter into litigation over what compensation they were owed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just a liberal arts major from OSU, but it speaks to the reason this committee's meeting, and I'm glad we're doing it. Thank you.
Thank you.
If I can just add to that, it is important that that is a point in time at which the precise dollar amount of reduction in value would have to be determined. That's a different question when we're facing to waive or not to waive. Mm-hmm. That would be extent of liability. And that each one of those cases that move forward then would be a damage claim that require a presentation of proof to the court of reduction in value. The state would have its appraisers probably, and each one of those would be battled out, much like a condemnation action probably.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Chair. And following up on that, and it is your opinion that at that point the waiver is off the table, it is only compensation?
Representative Roblin, that is an issue that has also yet to be decided. Whether a claimant would, in addition to compensation, be entitled to have the regulation waived.
Let's go this way. Representative Carlard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Striffler, if this legislative body takes no action to, quote, fix Measure 37, what's the future? How long can this go on?
Representative Garrard, I think that's true. What we will, if as Director Shetterly says, they are unable to act on claims within 180 days, which he says is a certainty, and I believe him, then we will face a lot of litigation over the amount of compensation at a minimum, as well as continue to litigate these number of significant issues regarding the interpretation and implementation of the measure.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
You bet.
To interpret that, we're talking about years and years.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to go to Senator George, and we'll come back across.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I find there's one question I've always wanted to ask, so since I've got you here, I'm asking. The Columbia River Gorge Commission and the regulating agency, is that a federal agency or a state agency? And how is the state? What's the state's position on that?
Senator George, the state's position is that it is not a state agency. It is a bi-state compact agency. So it's really neither a federal agency nor a state agency. It's a creature of both state and federal law.
Follow up? You may.
Stephanie, thanks. How would a citizen approach those regulations? Would you approach them as a state? I mean, if you're going to litigate it, how would you approach that? Is it a federal court case or a state court case? if you had a problem with what the Columbia River Gorge Commission did and its regulating agency, would you file in state court or would you file in federal court?
And I'm a little rusty on my Gorge Act, Senator George, but the Act itself has provisions for where to file, and I believe you can file in state court in either state, depending on where the property at issue lies, if I recall correctly.
Thank you, Stephanie.
And I assume, just for the clarification, when we say either state, we're talking about Washington or Oregon?
Yes, Senator.
All right. And let's see, I've got Representative Roblin, but before we go back, I just want to make sure I'm not forgetting anyone on this side. Representative.
Well, I was getting back to Representative Garg's futuristic question, what happens if? And my issue there is we can and should anticipate we're getting more 37 claims as well after that date. I mean, they continue depending on new regulations or other kinds of things and property. Is that not true? So this number could increase.
Yes. Co-chairs, Representative Roblin, it could increase, and in fact, I'm sure it will increase, and not only on the basis of new regulations that would trigger new claims, but also the measure is clear that claims can still be based on regulations going back before the effective date of the measure. The only difference today being that in order for those claims to be filed, the claimant must first go through a land use application and you have that application either denied or conditioned on some regulation, and then that would translate to a right to file a Measure 37 claim. So I think it's a certainty that new claims will be coming in. I think we will not see the volume of claims certainly that we saw during the first 2 years, but I think you can expect that there will be a steady trickle of claims coming in over time.
All right, one more question. We're going to move on after this. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lane, I want to, if you could give us a little advice from your perspective. In land use law is always litigious. That's why we have Land Use Board of Appeals. There's cases that run through the Land Use Board of Appeals all the time. In issues like ballot measures, there's expedited process for litigation. Would you advise this committee to create an expedited legal process? Because we've done it before, all of our land use laws are complex, and so therefore it creates tons of litigation every year. And this is part of the land use process. Would you advise this committee to go some direction like that to be more consistent with the rest of the land use laws?
Chair, Senator George, thanks for that question. I would advise the legislature to create an expedited process for legal review. I'd want to make sure that the court administrator was in here and had a chance to talk to you about how they feel about expedited review. That said, I will tell you that even in the last session, we sort of mulled around the idea of maybe the mother of all declaratory judgment actions, where you just say, come up with every question you can think of, and we'll just litigate that. I'm not sure that that's effective, especially in that what you see in these claims is individuals either asserting rights or defending rights. And I think that even if you were to try to bring claims together and move them forward, there's still going to be an ongoing filing of these claims. Now, if you were to create some sort of a special court, like LUBA, to hear these things, that'd be another thing, I guess, altogether. But frankly, I'd not gone there.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here with us. You're standees if you want to stay with us to watch the rest, please do so. Sheila Martin.
Thank you.
We'll turn it on over here. We should just be able to pop it open.
So we're going to redo. Just want to make sure that.
Yep.
Takes a second. Keeps moving.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sheila Martin. I'm the director of the Institute of Portland Metropolitan Studies at Portland State University. I appreciate your inviting me to come and provide you with some information about the database that we have been putting together. And if you're confused, I'm not surprised. This is a difficult issue that we're dealing with, and we're all approaching it from a different perspective, and so there's lots of different numbers floating around out there. I'll do my best to clarify those for you and to explain to you what some of the differences might be caused from. Before I get into the numbers, I want to give you a little bit of background on why we started doing this and how we're approaching it, because that will help clarify the numbers. When Measure 37 passed, we realized that there was not going to be any kind of a joint county-state way to collect information on claims, and so we started trying to put together a database, and we were using volunteers at first, and that only gets you so far, even with students. So after a while, we requested and received some funding from the Oregon Community Foundation to put some staff on this project and be much more thorough about the way we collect data. We've gathered these data primarily from county planning agencies. We have gone after their documents that refer to Measure 37, the claims documents as well as the staff reports. For the older claims, we have better information because we've been able to glean this information from the staff reports. For the big rush of claims that's just come in, the data is not quite as reliable because we're taking it primarily just from the claim forms. And the claim forms are very inconsistent across counties. Some have more information than others, and there is no requirement that all the data be filled out. So I will be clear with you about when I am basing information on a small percentage of the claims. Each claim, just to clarify some of the issues that we were talking about earlier, each claim can be filed with both the state and the county and the city, and we only count that as a single claim. So each piece of property is a separate claim, and if we get a state claim in that we already have a county claim for, we just check a box to indicate that a state claim has been filed as well, and also check the information from the county documentation and see if it matches what we have from the state. And I have a few other caveats. This map shows the status of our updates. The gold counties are those for which we have all of the information from the counties up to the December 4th deadline, and the white counties are those for which we do not have complete data. So if any of you have any pull with any of the planning directors in these counties, we'd appreciate some help. In some cases, we are actually driving out to the county seats and standing in front of the copy machine and copying the claim documents. You can imagine how thrilled the county planning directors are when they get a phone call from us asking them to send us their Measure 37 documentation on top of all the other things that they're dealing with right now. We do not have up-to-date data on state claims. I will show you what we have, but it is not up-to-date. As Lane mentioned, the Department of Administrative Services is playing a ferocious game of catch-up, and they do send us spreadsheets every couple of weeks with information on it. The last one I saw had little more than claimants' names and claim numbers, which isn't very helpful as far as the information that we're trying to get out. We are also working to get city claims better represented in our data, but with all of the county claims that are out there, we've been focusing on our efforts with respect to the county claims. So let's start with the raw numbers. The total number of claims we have in our database is 6,350 claims and 514,164 acres. As you can see, we only have about 2,600 of the 6,500 state claims that Lane mentioned. We have about 6,000 county claims, and Art Schlack will tell you later that he thinks it's closer to 7,100 claims. As Lane mentioned, we expect the county and state claim numbers to come together as everybody gets caught up on entering their data. This gives you an idea of what the numbers looked like with respect to the total number of claims approaching the deadline. So it shows the big bump in the filing of claims as the December 4th deadline approached, and also the impact of the various court decisions on the claim activity at the county level. On a regional basis, the majority of the claims and also the acreage has been filed in the Northwest and Willamette Valley. We define that region as the Portland metropolitan counties,
and the Willamette Valley counties, and that includes Hood River County as well. The Southern District includes Josephine, Douglas, Jackson, and Klamath counties, and they have the next highest number of claims. The Coast region includes Tillamook, Clatsop, Lincoln, Coos, and Curry County. And Central is Wasco, Jefferson, Deschutes, and Crook County. This shows you the acreage that we have in our database by county. The Washington County has the highest acreage in the state, followed by Baker County. And there are a couple of counties that are not on this chart, either because we don't have up-to-date information or because their acreage is pretty small. This shows you the total number of acreage by region, the largest claims in each region, and the average size of a claim in each region. There are a couple of really huge claims, of almost 15,000-acre claim in Washington County and a 16,000-acre claim. That one is in the eastern region. And if I'm not mistaken, that one is in Baker County. This is a map we just finished today for your benefit. What we have done here is taken each township, which is approximately 640 acres, and the darker areas show where the greatest number of claims are. So the darkest regions are townships where there are between 74 and 120 claims in that particular township. And this is the same thing, except it shows acreage as a percentage of the acreage in the township. So the darkest squares are townships where over 60% of the acreage in the township is subject to Measure 37 claim.
They're over 60 or over 50?
It's 50. I guess I need my glasses fixed here.
I have mine on. That's why I saw it.
As I mentioned, we just finished these today, these particular maps. Although the total acreage in the state is less than 1%, there are a few counties where the acreage of Measure 37 claims is particularly high. I have highlighted those here. What I've done here is I've taken the total acreage of Measure 37 claims and divided it by the total acreage in the county as provided by the Oregon Blue Book. And then in the second set of counties, in the second set of columns, is the total acreage on EFU or farm forest land, and I've taken that as a percentage of total land and farms as provided by the 2002 Census of Agriculture. So that's just to give you some perspective on the acreage and how that compares with the acreage that we have in farms in these counties. As you can see in Washington County, 14% of the total land area of the state has a Measure 37 claim on it. I mean, in the county, 14% of the total land area in Washington County has a Measure 37 claim on it.
And 18%.
This is a map which I think you have already seen. This is a Hood River County Measure 37 claims. These are to scale, so these are maps of the actual tax lots that are involved in the Measure 37 claim. We would like to be able to do this map for every county in the state. There are some issues with respect to getting the GIS files from each individual county, and so we haven't been able to do that, and neither has the state. We're working together on trying to get that resolved. So as Lane mentioned, the majority of these claims are on resource lands. 61% of the claims and 68% of the acreage is on resource land. Those big yellow areas are claims for which we do not know what kind of zoning those claims represent. Mm-hmm. I want to be very upfront with what we don't know as well as what we do know here. Of the resource land claims, over 50% of those are EFU land,
Some of them are also farm and forest. Some are forest only. And then there's this farm or forest and other. There are a whole lot of claims that where there's a lot of parcels, some of them are zoned, you know, some of them might be zoned rural residential, some of them might be zoned EFU, and so I just threw them into that category, farm, forest, and other. When we get down to the type of development that's being requested, this is where our data gets very sketchy. In a lot of counties, they have not asked the claimants for that information, and in many cases, the claimants have not told us that information. We have this data on about half of the claims, but the claims for which we have data, the overwhelming majority, is for residential development, as Mr. Shetterly mentioned. This slide refers to proposed land divisions. Again, our data is not complete here, particularly on the new claims. We only have data for about 58% of the claims. And where we do have data, we know that a larger percentage of these proposals are for subdivisions, which would be four or more lots, than for partitions, which would be three or fewer lots. And those subdivisions tend to be on larger claims, so they represent proportionally a larger percentage of acreage. This is a frequency bar chart that shows the total number of lots requested by a Measure 37 claim. This data is for 40% of the claims that are in our database provide this data. The total number of lots requested is just over 39,000. And what this tells you is that 1,031 claims have requested between 1 and 3 lots, 795 claims have requested 4 to 9 lots, and so on and so forth. We have 27 claims where over 200 lots have been requested in terms of land division. This is a similar chart that refers to requested dwellings. Only 23% of the claims do we know the answer to this question. But using that data, 15,000 new residences, new dwellings have been requested, and 564 of those are only for one, 447 for two to five, and so on. This is kind of a fun chart. $10 billion in compensation has been demanded according to the data that we have in our database. The average demand is $2.5 million. The maximum compensation that's been requested is $846 million. I also calculated the compensation per acre. I took out claims where the compensation requested was zero, so that we wouldn't have a mean skewed downward. So the average compensation requested is highest in the Northwest Willamette Valley region. Overall, the average per acre is about $125,000. So I just want to remind you that we are continuing to try to catch up with this huge flood of claims that came in. The one nice thing about the December 4th deadline is that, as Mr. Shetterly mentioned, the claims will be coming in at a much slower rate, and that will give us a chance to catch up, to do some better job of mapping, and try to work with my colleagues in the counties and at the state to make sure that our data are starting to approach one another. As we get our data updated, I would be happy to provide each of you with that updated information.
That'd be wonderful. Ms. Martin, thank you very much. Senator Johnson?
A couple of quick questions. First one, the GIS difficulties. Is that anything that you need help with resolution about? I mean, it seems that that data ought to be available and readily offered to you.
There's a project called ORMAP, which is supposed to be a statewide tax lot database.
Right.
Not all of the counties have agreed to provide that data publicly yet, and that is the difficulty. The ORMAPS project cannot give us all the data. We have to go individually to each county and sign data sharing agreements with them.
One more, Mr. Chair. Is there a way to compel better data? I mean, what you've told us tonight is terribly important, and trying to figure out this one house on 5 acres or five houses on 1 acre, seems to be an incredibly important question. Is there a collection point where that data could be retrieved? As the forms are submitted, can there be a more detailed question that asks what the intended use is?
As the staff reports are written, generally the quality of the data gets much better because the county and state planning staff go through these claims and, you know, get much better information about all of these variables. However, not all of the counties are doing a good job or, you know, sort of pursuing the issue of what the claimant is proposing. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily forecast the future either. So it would be great if, as the staff reports were written, a better indication of the intent of the claimant could be written into those staff reports.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess being around land use law for a long time, I was actually kind of surprised about something, which is, according to your charts, this only affected 0.8% of the land in the state of Oregon, and if you took out the big claims, it's less than it's about 0.5%. Can you, in the future, if you're helping us out, can you separate out those big, massive claims like in Washington County, which kind of distort those numbers? Because actually, that's a fairly minuscule amount of the state, and I guess I was kind of surprised by that because it's such a small percentage of actually the land mass of the state that's affected by 37 claims.
I could do an analysis that pulls out some of the bigger claims, yes.
Yeah, that would be really helpful, because I think I was actually expecting something dramatically different. When it was that small of a percentage of the land mass of the state, it actually kind of shocked me.
It's a big state.
Yeah.
And also, Ms. Martin, I think with that understanding, I think it would be important for you to be able to also pull out the federal-owned land from private. I think it would be give us the comparison of, you know, apples with apples. Representative Clem, I think you had a question.
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the chart discussing counties with the largest impact, in Hood River it talks about 13,823 acres. It said the claim acres that are on EFU, FF, and Forest something, I'm sure, 2,993. I know that I and others probably are in receipt of a letter, and letters can be wrong, that discuss roughly 10,300 and some acres on the 14,000 to 15,000 acres in pear production or in production. There is 14,000 to 15,000 acres in production, and supposedly 10,000 of those acres have claims covering them. And I don't see how you could have exclusive farm use on all of those orchards and only be at 3,000. So I'm trying to sort out in my own head what's happening.
You know, I could get back to you on that. I'd have to take a look at it. Could be that some of those orchards had other designations on them.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those claims had other designations on them, so they got thrown into that category incorrectly. I'll check on that number and get back to you.
Yeah, facts are important. Mr. Chairman, I do know that orchard production, 15,000 acres, is about right, because this is my declaration of a lack of conflict of interest, because we didn't file Measure 37 claim, but we own 80 acres outside of Parkdale, and we're in orchard production, but aren't counted in those figures.
And Representative Roblin.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Just a clarification on that. Is that chart relating to all claims or just 40% of the claims? I mean, a number of your other charts you mentioned that it represented not the total. So
we have zoning information on about 60 to 65% of the claims. So part of the issue could be that we don't have current zoning information on many of those claims in Hood River. So thank you for pointing that out, and I will definitely check on that.
Okay. All right, thank you. Ms. Martin, again, thank you very much, and appreciate your willingness to share today and also work with us in the future with other updates that you may have.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Slack, why don't you come on up? And Lane, if you could come back, I think you had some late-breaking news or new numbers to give us. This is only just to get something on the record, and then we can always follow up on that, but I believe DAS is giving you some additional information.
It's an update on the claim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, again for the record, Lane Shaw, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Somebody must have been watching on the screen because I just got an updated set of numbers from DAS dated as of today. So this is hot off the press. It mostly addresses the number of claims received since December 4, and that's 85. So again, what I told you earlier was that the numbers were substantially correct in what we gave you. It does update also the number of claims that have been closed through a final order, 2013. I said we were at about 2,000 final orders. This bears out my estimate there. 2013 final orders. I have signed most of them myself. And so I just wanted to get you those updated numbers, and I will have this delivered to your offices tomorrow.
Thank you. And in fact, I'd ask you to get it to our committee assistant administrator. That way we can get it out and make sure it's part of the record.
And I'll do it.
Thank you. Art?
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Art Slock. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And I guess I'll thank you for having me here this evening. I'm not sure sometimes.
But you're welcome.
Let me, you could probably say the same thing yourself, I'm sure, spending your evening here. Before I start, I really want to try and put the relationship between counties and the state in some perspective. And I think you've heard some of it this evening from Lane. But when we started this Oregon land use planning program some 30 years ago, we started a program where it's intended to be a partnership between the state and cities and counties. The state basically has established with the land use planning goals the policy, the overall state policy. And it's been the responsibility and of the counties and the cities to implement the statewide planning program. And what that brings me to is the fact that counties for the last 30 years have been implementing the state's policy as it relates to agriculture and forest lands, the management of those lands. And we have done that with our comprehensive plans. We have done that with our implementing ordinances, our zoning ordinance, our subdivision and partitioning ordinances on behalf of, again, this partnership dealing with the overall statewide program. And since we have this partnership, we are in a partnership with the state and Measure 37 claims. I dare say that almost every claim that a county has had filed with it is also a claim that will be filed with the state of Oregon. Certainly any land that is zoned agriculture and forestry, subject to Goals 3 and Goals 4, many of the lands that are in rural designations are all based either on state statute or administrative rule. And I've said before that basically the only thing a county can tell a property owner is what size of a sign he can put on his piece of property and how far he can put the buildings from the front yard, side yard, and rear yard. Other than that, ladies and gentlemen, state statute and administrative rule, you'll find those requirements in local ordinances. So with that as kind of setting the relationship between counties and the state, we find, and we've provided you a survey of the number of claims that have been filed by county. This was done the early part of December, and you'll see a date of December 15th. We had a couple of adjustments as some counties were going through their boxes, how many claims they had, and so we did do a couple of adjustments. But the counties have received 7,150 claims at this point, and I'm very confident in that number that has come from the counties and either that or personal contact at this point. And of that number, from November 1st through December 4th, counties received 3,672, over half of the claims that they had received up until that date. And you can see, county by county, the number of claims filed and then the number of claims that have been were filed within that county based on what's been referred to as the bubble or the bulge, however you want to refer to it. To give you an example, and I do want to say each county's different. We got 36 counties, and they look at there's not one process. There's not one application form. There is a variety of within those 36 counties as to what is required and what their manner of processing Measure 37 claims are done. And I will also note that some counties do it on a tax lot basis, and other counties may do it on a tract basis. So you may have three or four tax lots that comprise a tract and one ownership, and that constitutes one Measure 37 claim. But as an example, Clackamas County, which is the winner of the race, has 1,054 claims that have been filed within Clackamas County. 466 were filed within that basically four-week plus period. Washington County, 873, 347 within the period. Marion County, 473, and they received 280. And we can go on. Certainly some counties, as you can see, have very few. Some counties were, and we don't have a county that doesn't have any, but there were some counties that right up to the end didn't have any Measure 37 claims. And they were, shall we say, real happy to be in that special classification. So we have a lot of claims, and that is extremely problematic. I know you've heard Lane's comments with respect to the resources that it's necessary to have at the state level to process their 3,000 claims. These counties don't have any place to go to get additional resources. Sure. These counties, many of them, are in the process of laying off people because their revenue at this point, because of secure rural schools, secure rural schools, is beginning to lessen. So they're having to, you know, take measures to process these claims with the existing resources they have, which in some instances is pulling their entire planning department, the majority of their legal staff, and it has an impact on development within those counties. I wish we had an emergency board that counties could go to ask for support, especially when we're processing, as I indicated the point earlier, we're processing claims that we have in our rules and regulations because of the state statute and administrative rules. I wouldn't suggest that we might not have some of the same, but I would suggest to you that we wouldn't have them all. So with that, let me just move away from the magnitude of the claims and the magnitude of the problems that the counties have and their need for some assistance in that regard. We have, again, the same problem that the state has. I want to call your attention to this little graphic. Okay, the little clock. Mm-hmm. Little clock that's ticking. And for this, basically, let's just assume that you came into Marion County on November 1st and filed your Measure 37 claim. Now, the county's already got some claims that they've already had that they're in the process of filing, and counties have done those on a first-come, first-served basis. But on November 1st, you filed your claim. And claim may have not even been opened yet to start processing. But the point is, November 1st is up here, and we're looking at 180 days before the bell rings, okay? We're down here right now, today. We're 84 days into the 180 days that the counties have to process the claim. And pretty soon, we're going to get up here. That bell may ring, which means that the claimant has made the decision, because no decision has been made on his claim, he's going to go to circuit court. Counties have the same problem that the state has, that we don't have the resources for the attorneys to go to court to file, you know, to deal with all these issues. So this is going to change daily. based on the claims, needless to say. But I think it gives you at least a graphic and hopefully, you know, the fact that time's running out. We're halfway through the 180 days at this point, and we're in the third week of the session. And we haven't seen any, shall we say, relief from the problem of all the claims that have been filed and the need to process those within 180 days. We ask for your help in that regard. And on that, Mr. Chair, or Mr. Co-Chairs, I'll conclude my comments and answer questions should you have any.
Mr. Schlack, thank you very much. We're going to start with Senator Beyer since he had a question that came off the chart. So did you still have a question regarding the chart?
Yeah, I guess. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the chart you gave us, you have a column that says timber company submitting claims. I guess I'm curious to know what that means and how you define it into a timber company.
Mr. Co-Chairs, Senator Beyer, at the time we did the claim, or we're doing the survey, and the survey was just intended to be real, you know, a couple of questions. It was reported that and I won't say a lot because we didn't know, and we still don't know, couldn't tell you how many, that some timber companies, commercial timber companies, so that people that we thought were in timber business for the long haul, were filing Measure 37 claims. And so we just simply asked the question, yes or no, has a timber company or, you know, filed a claim within your county? And the answer, as you can see, some of them came back yes, some came back no. We didn't try and true that. We didn't try and define it either at this point. But that simply is the question that we ask.
Follow up?
Yes.
What significance does that mean, and why did you put that on this chart? Yeah. I mean, why didn't you put number of homeowners, number of fishermen, number of farmers, can you tell me why you included that category in this chart?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Senator Beyer, again, it was the fact that we were aware that some major timber companies, and I would say, you know, and it's been talked about, Plum Creek owns thousands of acres in timber production, Stimson Lumber Company, and I was a planning director in Washington County, so I know their holdings. I mean, I know a lot about some of their holdings, but some of these companies were filing Measure 37 claims, and we just wanted to find out in what counties this was an activity that was ongoing. Just that simple. We could have asked many more questions about agriculture, about other kinds of things, but we did not.
Other questions? Co-Chair McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Schleck, we heard from Director Shetterly that based on current staffing levels at the Department of Land Conservation and Development, it would take about 18 months to work through the pending claims. Do you have any parallel kind of number? And I realize the counties are a much more dispersed kind of situation, and your information would be more secondhand. But do you have any sense about what kind of a parallel estimate it would be for the counties? How long would it take if they didn't have any resources provided to them to add additional staffing to work through the pending claims?
Mr. Co-Chairs, 36 counties have had different ways of processing. A number of counties at this point are rethinking their processes that they, you know, and are changing their process because they're looking at trying to process these within the time frame that they have available to them. I couldn't really tell you whether we would be looking at X number of additional months or days to process these, because it's going to vary from county to county at this point. But I do know that looking at the urgency to process claims, they're going to try it. They'll do it fast. They probably won't do as much homework as they have been doing. And I would just conclude by saying an extension of time, I guess, that would work for the state would certainly work also for the counties.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Have you done any kind of calculation about the fiscal impact to counties in terms of dealing with the claims up to this point and projected forward? For example, you may have to have overtime or hired expertise. Some counties may not have heavy resources in their legal department. Any calculation on the cost to counties at a time when counties are particularly stressed financially?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, no, we have not asked that question. We could attempt to get a handle on that if it would benefit the committee at this point.
Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair. Have you also queried those counties that are failing to provide good data? We're looking at this holistically, and having data from 36 places would certainly be helpful. Is there anything you can do to urge some of the counties that aren't reporting clear data or reporting at all to participate in reporting?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Senator Johnson, I had to pick up the phone call and beg, borrow, steal, whatever, to get what little data I was able to get from them. The resources, especially in some of the rural areas, are minimal. And I knew if I asked more questions than really what I did, tell me the total number of claims and the ones you've done, I'd probably get tarred and feathered the next time I saw them.
Just a concluding comment, Mr. Chair. It seems, though, that if the counties come and ask for help, and I think it's a legitimate inquiry, that they ought to provide as much data as possible so we can define the scope of the problem, and they can be participatory in getting a global view of what all our sense of risk and liability and cost are.
Mr. Co-Chairs, Senator Johnson, I can send an email out tomorrow. And I'm not sure that if I do that, I'll get a response from everybody, but I can come up with maybe a selected group that I can provide you some data that would be representative of the counties that you see here that are most heavily impacted.
Any other questions? If not, first of all, I want to thank everyone in the audience for being here and being very observant and taking in the information that we have. And committee members, thank you very much for staying over a little bit. And we're going to go ahead and conclude. Our next meeting is set for this coming Thursday at 5. With that, we're adjourned.